This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and online at kexp.org. My guest this morning is Susan Frankel, a science writer whose work has appeared in the New York Times, Discover, Smithsonian, and Health, among other publications. She is also the author of American Chestnut, which won a 2008 National Outdoor Book Award. Susan Frankel is here today to tell us about her most recent book, Plastic, A Toxic Love Story, published in 2011. Welcome, Susan.
Hi, thanks for having me.
What led you to write your book, Plastic?
Well, I got interested in the problems of plastic. I live in San Francisco. There was a lot of debate and discussion about plastic for a number of years, and that started me thinking about them. And I decided to try a little thought experiment where I would spend a day without touching anything plastic. It seemed not a very difficult thing to do, and I didn't think it through very hard. So the first morning, on the appointed morning, I walked into the bathroom, and there was my plastic toilet seat. And I realized, this is going to be harder than I thought. And I decided to revise my plans and spend the day writing down everything I touched that was plastic. And by day's end, I had this very long list of things, both things I knew were plastic and kind of unexpected things, like my quote-unquote brass doorknob. And, you know, I looked at all this stuff and I realized I really had no idea why the assortment of things all counted as plastic. I didn't know where they came from. I didn't know what they were made of. And I didn't really know whether it was a problem that so much of my life was filled with plastic. And those all seemed rich questions, and I figured if I was asking them, probably other people were as well.
What were the reasons plastics were introduced into human culture? What were the advantages?
Well, you know, we think of plastic as sort of the enemy of the environment now, but ironically, the first plastics really were brought in and invented as a way to save natural resources. The very first plastic in this country invented was celluloid, which was invented in response to widespread concerns that ivory was becoming in short supply. Ivory was used for all sorts of things, from buttons to billiard balls. And in fact, the demand for ivory billiard balls prompted a billiard ball maker to run an ad offering $10,000 for anybody who could come up with a viable alternative to ivory. And that was the goad to the guy who invented celluloid. And really, up until the mid-20th century, that was largely what plastics were used for, to replace various kinds of natural materials that were becoming scarcer and scarcer.
What were some additional examples of the natural products that were becoming scarce and then replaced by plastic?
Celluloid was used to replace ivory. It was used to replace tortoiseshell. I talk about tortoiseshell combs in the book and how the development of celluloid combs actually took this pressure off of ivory and tortoiseshell. Bakelite, which a lot of people know from like kinds of bangles and jewelry you find at flea markets. Bakelite was actually invented to replace shellac, which I didn't realize until I was researching the book, is the product of a resin produced by the lac beetle. Shellac was in high demand in the early 20th century as an electrical insulator. And the trouble is, the country was wiring up like crazy, and lac beetles really couldn't keep up with the demand because it takes something like 15,000 lac beetles 6 months to produce enough of this resin to make a pound of shellac. So Bakelite was invented to replace that and became sort of one of the materials that allowed us to electrify rapidly in the early 20th century. The other plastics that came along were less likely to be developed to replace natural materials as much as designed for their own purposes. A lot of them came about because scientists were just experimenting with molecules and sort of seeing what they could do. And then they would have to go and find a market for them.
In what ways did plastics expand opportunities for people of limited means?
Well, these were materials that could be produced cheaply. So let's go back to the story of celluloid again. Prior to the development of celluloid, well, I tell the story of combs. Combs were often made of things like ivory and tortoiseshell. These are expensive materials and put beautiful combs beyond the means of the average person. You come along with something like celluloid or even Bakelite for that matter, and suddenly you have the ability to make consumer items for much less cost. And that helped kind of democratize consumer goods for a lot of people. Any shop girl could afford a celluloid comb that looked really fancy and looked beautiful, but might have only cost her pennies.
Would you just briefly comment on how plastic has been used in the artistic world and design?
Yeah, plastic, again, it's one of these things where plastic brought sort of this palette of materials that were amazing to artists and designers. These materials that could be made to do almost anything that people wanted and provide a kind of freedom that artists and designers hadn't seen before. So in the book, I tell the story of the plastic chair, and I sort of backtrack from those less than loved cheap plastic patio chairs that everybody has that, you know, sort of appear in the hardware stores every spring, back to the mid-20th century effort to create beautiful plastic furniture, which was a huge challenge for all of the great designers of that period, from Charles and Ray Eames to, you know, Saarinen and on. Those folks actually were trying very hard to figure out how to use plastic in creative ways and found that not only did it bring them freedom, but it also offered an opportunity to, again, democratize design, offer beautiful designs that would be affordable to regular folks. The story that I track in the book is how that quest sort of descended into a kind of commodification of these designs and of this technology, so that what you end up with are these kind of ill-designed, low-priced types of furniture.
Would you give a sense of our increased use of plastic over time?
It is exponential. If you look at growth curves of the plastics industry over the course of the 20th century, it's a really steep line, particularly after World War II, which is really when plastic kind of came into everyday life. One statistic I've seen is that in 1960, the average person used about 30 pounds of plastic a year, and today that figure is 300 pounds.
What forces drove an increase in plastic use over time?
Just the fact that it's so darn easy to manufacture and it's so cheap. Plastics came into widespread use after World War II, and part of that was that a lot of the plastics we know today, like polyethylene or polystyrene, were developed before World War II. The military requisitioned them for use during the war, and so you had this big production capacity that got built up during World War II. Come the end of the war, all these manufacturers have these supplies. They've got to go somewhere, and so they go into consumer markets. And at first, they went into kind of durable goods. I mean, it was after the war. People were flush. They had money to spend. You had this dramatic population boom. And people were eager to buy things like new refrigerators with plastic linings or new cars with plastic insides or, you know, Dacron clothes or whatever. But at a certain point, there's only so many cars and clothes and toys that people are going to buy. And what the plastics industry, I think, very consciously discovered is that there was a great market to be had in making disposable goods. And that's what's really driven a lot of the growth in plastics over the past several decades. About half of all plastics now go into disposable goods, single-use goods. You know, we could paint it as an industry conspiracy, but let's face it, disposability also provides great convenience, and we enjoy that as well. And it fits well into the kind of lifestyle that developed in the post-war years, where people are living in suburbs, shopping at self-serve stores, going to drive-in restaurants, and on the move a lot.
Would you remind us of the different types of plastic and what they're used for? Just a really brief overview.
There are lots and lots of different plastics. I mean, thousands of different plastics, but there are just a handful of the major plastics that are out there. They call them the commodity plastics. And some of those are polyethylene, which is probably the most common plastic. That is the plastic that's used in sandwich baggies and grocery bags. It's that filmy plastic that is sort of the sine qua non of packaging. There's polystyrene, which can kind of come in a couple of different varieties, but the way that most of us know it might be is a hard plastic that often is found in combs or as that kind of foamy plastic we call styrofoam. Actually, the technical term is expanded polystyrene. There's polyvinyl chloride, PVC or vinyl, which, you know, goes into a huge number of things, anything from the siding on homes to garden hoses. It can be flexible, it can be hard. Very, very versatile plastic. There's polypropylene, which is the number 5 plastic. You'll find it in yogurt tubs, margarine containers, things like that.
I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Susan Frankel, author of the book Plastic, A Toxic Love Story. And you are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. In your book, you point out the problems with plastics. What are the key problems with plastics?
You know, there are various problems with plastics, and it sort of depends on what your source of concern is. For some people, the problem is that they're made from fossil fuels, and so we're taking these finite resources and using them often for throwaway items. They have a carbon footprint in that sense. I think that probably the two most pressing problems with plastics are their persistence in the environment. These are molecules that are either actually engineered not to break down, or simply by virtue of being such big, complicated molecular structures, aren't compatible with the kind of microbes that are out there that tend to digest and break down materials. So you take something like a plastic cup, and you know, if it gets into the environment, it'll last for decades, for centuries. Practically speaking, polymers really don't ever go away. The other big set of issues around plastics is that they're made with various synthetic chemicals, and at least in the case of some plastics, we know that either the chemicals that are used in making them or that are added to them to confer certain properties can leach out. And some of these chemicals are thought to act as endocrine disruptors, to sort of interfere with the hormones that are in our body, with the network of glands that orchestrate development, and potentially may, if somebody's exposed, particularly at critical periods of development, they may interfere with the way they grow and develop, or interfere with fertility, or can produce various other kinds of health problems.
Would you comment on both the benefits and drawbacks of our current use of plastics in medicine?
Well, I tell the story in the book of the blood bag. The book is structured around different objects that allow me to sort of explore facets of the plastic story. And I chose the blood bag, or the IV bag, because it's made of vinyl. It's made of this material that's made flexible through the addition of these oily chemicals called phthalates. Now, the vinyl blood bag was a huge breakthrough in medicine. Up until that point, blood had been collected and stored in glass bottles. It didn't work very well. Bringing in a plastic blood bag made it much easier to collect the blood and to store and separate it in a kind of secure, sterile fashion. The medical establishment loves vinyl blood bags. The problem is that vinyl leaches this phthalate that I mentioned called DEHP, and DEHP can suppress production of testosterone. There are animal studies showing that high doses of DEHP are toxic to the testicles. There are also some studies, though it's not a consensus by any means, that low doses may have an impact on the male reproductive system, and there are sort of epidemiological studies to suggest that exposure to DEHP can be associated with reproductive problems, as well as allergies, asthma, liver toxicity, and sort of disruptions in thyroid function. The problem is that substitutes are still very expensive for DEHP, and I actually went into a neonatal intensive care unit where I saw this little tiny premature baby, barely a pound in weight, you know, just so fragile. And she was hooked up to vinyl IV bags. She had tubes running into her nose, into her mouth, into her belly button, into her veins. These were all delivering, you know, nutrients and medicine that were absolutely vital to this baby's health and to her survival. And at the same time, because they were made of vinyl, they were leaching DEHP that potentially may impact her health years from now. I mean, it's this awful double-edged sword. And there she was, you know, sort of just balanced right on it.
Is the medical community taking any steps to address this problem?
There are people in the medical community that are concerned. There are hospitals that have worked really hard to try to get vinyl and DEHP out. Kaiser has really worked hard to remove vinyl from it. The problem is that alternatives are more expensive. And in some cases, you simply can't find alternatives. You know, ironically, the blood bag is one of those. DEHP, while potentially a health hazard, also is a preservative for red blood cells. So blood bankers don't want to get rid of vinyl blood bags because they like what DEHP does to help preserve blood cells. There is a movement in hospitals to do something about it, but it's still by no means completely happening throughout the whole medical community.
The title of one of your chapters in your book is Battle of the Bag. Could you speak about how we got hooked on plastic shopping bags originally?
Yeah, and this is a battle Seattle is very familiar with. It's a funny story. I mean, plastic shopping bags, we think of them as having been here forever. They really only date to the mid-70s, and they came out of a conscious effort on the part of the polyethylene industry to find new markets for polyethylene. By that time, polyethylene had replaced paper dry cleaner bags and paper produce bags, and they were looking for something new, and they looked at shopping bags and said, well, here, this is a new place that we can go. So the industry developed the plastic shopping bag. and brought it in and actually found at first the grocers didn't like them. They were hard to free from other bags. Checkers would lick their fingers to get the bag free, and shoppers didn't like that. They didn't like that the bags flopped over when you stuck them in your car. And so the industry actually sent out trainers around to grocery stores around the country showing people how to use and pack these bags. But, you know, this started in 1976. By the early 80s, plastic had pretty much replaced paper at the checkout stand.
Could you review for us the environmental problems with the plastic bags?
Well, again, a plastic bag is another case where you've got sort of a mixed bag, so to speak. On the one hand, as the plastics industry points out, plastic bags have a lower carbon footprint than paper bags. They take less energy to produce. They use less water. Arguably, they're produced in a less toxic fashion. Problem is, plastic, unlike paper bags, will persist in the environment if they get out in the environment. And plastic bags are very, very aerodynamic. They're a prominent source of litter. Even if you actually throw them away, they're still prone to fly free from the back of garbage trucks, from the face of landfills. And they fly around. If they get to a recycling plant, they can screw up the recycling machinery, clog up the conveyor belts. If they get into waterways, they can get out into the ocean. In developing countries, plastic bags are actually a serious problem when they get into storm drains because they'll clog the drains and they contribute to flooding. And of course, if they get into the ocean, into rivers, animals can mistake them for food. They can choke on them. I think that to some extent, the hazards of the bags to wildlife have been a little bit overstated because by the time they get out to the middle of the ocean, they've pretty much been pounded into bits. But nonetheless, I mean, they contribute to plastic in the ocean. And at least, you know, closer into coastal areas, you'll see intact bags floating around, which can be mistaken by wildlife for food.
Where do efforts to reduce use of plastic shopping bags currently stand?
Boy, big fight. I just read this morning that Maryland, Montgomery County in Maryland, just passed a 5-cent fee on bags, which is great. That's the second community in the country to do so after Washington, D.C. As of now, I believe there are about 21 communities that have either banned or restricted bags and something like a dozen countries that have also taken action against bags. And the plastics industry is fighting this very hard. There's a big battle in Oregon going on right now over their proposal to restrict bags. But ironically, I mean, it truly is a grassroots movement. There's no national campaign to ban the bag. It's different communities looking at them and seeing the various kinds of problems that these, you know, free bags cause in their locale.
You are listening to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Susan Frankel, author of the book Plastic, A Toxic Love Story. What have been some of the key efforts to make the plastics industry more environmentally friendly?
Well, one of the things actually that the industry's been doing since the early 80s is something called Operation Clean Sweep. They've been doing this on their own, which is a program to get them to do a better job of keeping the little pre-production pellets, these sort of little rice grain size pellets that plastic is shipped around in, to keep them from getting off of factory floors, getting into storm drains. Because when these pellets get out into the ocean, they can be actually quite a problem. And the industry doing an okay job at that. There is a stepped-up effort now because I think of the fight around bags and other kinds of takeout packaging. The industry is doing, at least giving lip service and putting some more effort into voluntary recycling programs. Truthfully, I think that what really makes the difference is when you develop policies that require the industry and manufacturers and producers to be responsible for disposing of their products and packaging once they've kind of reached the end of their useful lives. Those kinds of policies in Europe and in Canada are what have really contributed to better packaging, more recyclable packaging, and stepped up recycling rates. Left to their own devices, I think the industry will do a modicum of recycling, but not at the level that's really needed.
Would you comment on bioplastics and to what extent they can make a contribution to being more environmentally friendly?
There's a huge interest in the industry right now to find renewable sources for plastics, to get away from gas and oil as a sort of starting ingredients for plastics. Bioplastics are great but they're not a panacea for the problems associated with plastics. I guess the short answer to this is, if we want to engineer safer, more environmentally friendly plastics, we have to make the effort to. Just because something is made of plants doesn't necessarily mean it will biodegrade. It doesn't necessarily mean that hazardous chemicals won't be used in its production or as additives. It doesn't necessarily mean that it will be recyclable. You know, the corn-based plastic PLA, which is probably the most prominent bioplastic out there right now, it's a great plastic. It's theoretically compostable, but only if you have an industrial-scale composting facility, and most communities don't.
To what extent are plastics recycled in the U.S.?
It's a dismal story. The overall rate is less than 10%, and even plastic beverage bottles, the number one plastic beverage bottles that have the little number one on the bottom, that's the most recycled kind of plastic. Even that, only one out of four beverage bottles are recycled. The rest are generally either landfilled or incinerated or, in worst case scenario, littered.
What are the obstacles to recycling?
There are a lot of different obstacles that I discuss in the book. Part of it's intrinsic to plastic. It's not like glass, where there's just one kind of glass or two kinds if you count colors. There are lots of different plastics out there, and they look alike, but they can't be recycled together. So that's a challenge for recycling facilities. That's one problem. Another problem is that I think people just don't consider these things valuable. So much of it goes into throwaway stuff, and people just throw it away. I think a third problem, for instance, in the case of the bottles, is that we don't have container deposit laws that put a nickel or a dime on the bottle if you return it. States that have those laws have much higher recycling rates. Unfortunately, the beverage industry has fought those laws really hard, and the plastics industry hasn't really weighed in and tried to push them.
How can we best balance the utility of plastics versus the environmental costs?
That's a tough one. What I discovered in working on the book is that it's always a series of trade-offs, and we have to be aware of what those trade-offs are and then sort of think through, is it worth it? Sometimes it is, sometimes it's not. I mean, in the case of something like the plastic bags, we think about those as free bags because we don't see literally the environmental costs, which when San Francisco was trying to calculate it, you know, calculated it at 17 cents a bag as opposed to being free. I think one place to start is that we need to get off of our addiction to single-use plastics. We just need to recognize that the convenience of disposables come with tremendous costs, both to the environment as well as social costs. And I think we really have to think that through and think which of these conveniences really make sense for us as a society and which ones are we now willing to let go of.
Do we really need plastic?
Absolutely. We cannot get away from plastic. I mean, it is thoroughly woven into modern life. We are thoroughly dependent on it. And I often say, we're not going to clothe and feed and heal and house the world without plastic or, you know, just on the basis of natural materials. There's too many of us and there are too few natural resources. But we absolutely have to learn how to produce and use plastics more wisely. I think if we do, they can be a great benefit to humanity. But not till we figure that one out.
What do you see as the trends for plastic use in the future?
Unfortunately, I see, you know, just an ever-increasing push for single-use plastics. My sister, who's a chaplain in a hospital, was telling me that there are actually single-use communion packets in her hospital. And the fact of the matter is that where a lot of the growth for plastics is projected is in the developing world. The extent to which those go into durable goods, that's a great thing. But a lot of what we are exporting to the developing world is the single-use habit, and that's a real problem.
In your book, you referred to a project where you collected your plastic trash for a week. Would you tell us about that and what you learned?
Well, that was another eye-opening experiment, and I sort of got the idea from that from a blogger named Beth Terry, who has been trying to live plastic-free for a long time. And, you know, what I discovered, most of it was packaging. A lot of it was wasteful packaging, needless packaging. And I'm embarrassed, you know, I admit in the book, I'm embarrassed to say that what I discovered in that was how mindless my shopping is. You know, that I was, for instance, I can't remember the exact number, but I think there were 5 bags of bread, several of which had little heels of the bread because my kids won't eat the heels of the bread. But what it meant is that I was buying bread without sort of really thinking through, have I finished up the last loaf? And I think that's the kind of style of living that plastic facilitates, just sort of working on autopilot, accumulating without really thinking about what you already have. When you start thinking about plastic, you instantly go past plastic to broader issues. You have to start looking at the way you live, the way you eat, the way you move around the world. And so for me, that experiment not only cued me into my needless plastic trash, but it also drew me up in my tracks and made me think a little bit harder about how I live in general.
Well, what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
Well, I think we're at a turning point in our relationship with plastics. We've made more in the last 10 years than in almost the entire previous century. And I think we're starting to recognize that this relationship we have has unhealthy elements. So I think it's time that we start, A, recognizing our dependence on plastic and really thinking through hard how we use it and whether there are more sustainable, safer, environmentally friendly ways to use it. We have to kick the single-use habit for starters, but then beyond that, I think we really need to rethink the proper place plastic has in our lives.
Well, thanks so much for being here, Susan.
Thank you so much for having me.
You have just been listening to Susan Frankel, author of the book Plastic, A Toxic Love Story, published in 2011 by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt Publishing Company. For more information, check on the web at susanfrankel.com. Again, that's SusanFrenkel.com. The Sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters program you have just heard will be on the streaming archive section of KEXP's website at kexp.org for the next 14 days. In addition, Sustainability segment interviews are available as podcasts. Go to kexp.org, click on Podcasting, and scroll down to Mind Over Matters Sustainability segment. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the Sustainability segment again next week on 90.3 FM and KEXP. dot org.